resorts, homes, and a newly built hospital have been washed away.
Communication is down all over the country. Everybody was just rushing up to the closest highest point.
I'm just holding on for dear life here.
Pacific prepared.
The warnings were going out. The extent to which people took heed of the warnings is another question.
Very much a wake-up call.
People were prepared, and that's why we've got less lives lost than we could have had.
People need to know what to do, and it's not difficult.
We provide the right information to people, and they can act accordingly.
Pacific kissing was.
Pacific, you feel I must prepare.
Pacific prepared.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Prepared, where the Pacific comes together to share information that can save lives, save loved ones, and save livelihoods. I'm Aaron Carney. Coming up in this episode, we visit the first ever Pacific community to be relocated because of disaster potential. Tonga takes on the challenge of earthquake preparation, and we go in search of the perfect flood early warning system. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life, your family, your home, your land, or your village are not. So, let's prepare.
It was a terrifying night. Everything was shaking and getting pounded by debris.
We had to make sure they have a safe shelter and drinking water.
Helping you stay safe, Pacific prepared.
A magnitude 5.4 offshore earthquake struck 75 kilometres southeast of the Solomon Islands capital Honiara this week. According to the US Geological Survey, the tremor occurred at a depth of 16 kilometres. No tsunami warning was issued, no damage was done. But a similar event nearby in the future could be devastating. People in the Solomon Islands town of Taro know that if their tiny island is hit by a tsunami, the provincial capital will likely be entirely swamped. It's a fear no one can continue to live with, so they are preparing for that disaster by making sure they won't be there when it happens. Pacific Prepared Solomon Islands correspondent Georgina Kakia reports on the relocation of Taro, the first of its kind in the Pacific.
What I was remember, I rise up then come inside now. You know, this kind of wave, yeah? No more, hemi see, no more, hemi rise, no more, hemi level machine, hemi come inside the land.
Marklin Biliki, a resident on Taro Island. Taro is home to about 1,000 residents.
The current provincial capital in Taro Island is only a small island. It's about 0.5 square kilometers land area, and about 40% of it comprised of creeks and waterlogged area. And also a bigger part of it has the airstrip on it, which means that only less than 50% of the island accommodates the provincial offices, residents, and other commercial entities from the province.
Isaac Lekelalu is the coordinator for the Churchill Bay Township project.
For me, as a person who goes in full-time to do this project, it becomes my passion for the people of Churchill, to be able to get them a good place where all of them can come and also have a place to live, a place to visit, and also to get services very close to the people, because coming to Honiara capital, it's very expensive for us.
Churchill Bay is the site for the new township on the mainland, and the relocation of Taro project is now called the Churchill Bay Township Project.
The most important part of this project actually started in 2016 when we have a local planning scheme under the Town and Country Planning Act. This planning scheme is the strategic document which guides the planning and development of the township. So we continued the planning stage with feasibility studies to relocate the Taro Hospital from Taro Island to the mainland. We also completed the relocation of the Churchill Bay Provincial Secondary School to a new site, because the current site was earmarked for the international port and industry. And we also completed the feasibility studies for renewable energy infrastructure and the telecommunications infrastructure. And now through Solomon Water and ADB and World Bank funding, this year they will embark on completing the feasibility studies for water supply and wastewater infrastructure.
Mr. Lekelalu says with his background in climate change and risk reduction, he knows that the people on Taro are faced with a grim situation.
Should there be a big earthquake that generates tsunamis, if that happens, models prove that Taro Island will be submerged. Most of it will be underwater. And that's my fear. It can happen anytime.
There is no evacuation center on the island, and the National Disaster Management Office, NDMO, is also worried about the plight of the people on the island.
The location of Taro, as it is very close to the earthquake trench. And if you look at earthquake history around that area, it's quite frequent. One big one would generate a tsunami, and so high risk to tsunami, and therefore the idea of relocating to mainland is a good one, and one which the government should support. Choice of province politicians, leaders should be encouraging that move as soon as possible.
Director of the National Disaster Management Office, Lottie Yates.
Before modern technology came along, our communities were already there. Disasters had happened in the past, and what we do in this instance is to enhance and strengthen the strengths that are already in the communities. We understand the fact that technology nowadays sort of taking over everything from, in this case, early warning. And in the absence of that, the question is, what do we do? Do we say every man for himself, or do we work on the strengths that are already in existence in the communities? Our people, our communities, has always been very resilient. And so working on those strengths, I think the main focus that the NDMO is doing is working with partners such as World Vision, Oxfam, and our other NGOs, local NGOs and church groups, to make communities a little bit more aware of the risks that they face or possibly will face due to, you know, the impact of climate change. What do you say, more frequent events now happening with the impacts a little bit more bad for the communities if they do happen.
In addition to work in moving the township, Chisel Premier Watson Goloni is calling on the government now to regard the Chisel Bay Township project as a national priority.
Being Prime Minister, you must receive many help from the time. Because so that I mentioned, you know, through climate change, I would tell him that after 50 years, this Taro Island is underwater. But something that might help.
Pacific Prepared, Solomon Islands correspondent Georgina Kakia reporting on the race to relocate Taro. With many other towns and villages across the Pacific feeling just as vulnerable, we will continue to follow progress on that enormous challenge and hope it is complete before disaster strikes.
Be informed.
Be ready.
Pacific Prepared.
And the Solomons isn't the only Pacific nation preparing for earthquakes right now. Tonga has been one of the Pacific Islands hardest hit by disasters, especially extreme weather, in recent years. Mercifully, the current cyclone season has spared the kingdom from much of its fury. Anasiu Falakano from the Tonga Broadcasting Commission has taken advantage of this break in the weather to speak with CEO of the Tonga Ministry of Meteorology, Environment, Information, Disaster, Energy and Climate Change, Paula Ma'au, and discovered now is the time to focus on preparation, and some attention has turned to earthquakes.
Tonga is approaching the end of the cyclone season. CEO, what is your main concern now?
The main concern for me is preparedness. How well we prepared. You know, the cyclone season is the 6 months of the year. And after that, we have to review what we have done, the preparedness. But to me, for us, for this current cyclone season, luckily, We didn't have any cyclone, major one coming in our way. But we found a very good time for us to sit back and lessons learned how well we prepared for any cyclone or any major hazards to hit us, natural disaster. Cyclones, we can trace the cyclones, the impact of climate change, and also flash flooding and all those things. But for the seismic activities, for the earthquakes and all those things, so we put stronger emphasis on information we get from our partners on the seismic activities. Especially, we have noticed that more frequent seismic activities are happening recently for the past few years and even for the last few days, the last few months. So we have to get more information on that because we can't predict an earthquake or even tsunami coming after that. Our preparedness, for this second season, we concentrate more on our preparedness because we think and we believe the more we prepare, the more resilient we are to facing all these natural disasters coming.
You mentioned various public consultations have been held, focusing on public awareness and educating the public about the significance of preparedness. Knowing what to do when a cyclone strikes, do you think the people are now better informed and know more on what to do in times of preparedness?
Not all, because the reason why I say that, even when you explain to the people number of times, they still get nervous when a disaster hits. So, as I said, even when you explain to them this is what you should do, but when it hits, it's a different story altogether. But that's what we do. So we also have to strengthen our response, immediate response, as required from time to time when disaster hits. So we have various committees in the Outer Islands, and also we have a village committees chaired by the town officers. So what we do is to inform not only those committees in the Outer Islands, but also the town committees, so that the district and town officers are responsible for carrying out these activities to their own people in their own community, own village.
I understand that recently there are more evacuation centres on the main island of Tuatapu and some on the outer islands as well. How does it help with your work, especially in times of disaster?
That's right. That's the exact plan, to have more evacuation centres safe, you know, strong enough to withstand category 5 cyclones in the villages. Some of the villages, you know, didn't have one. Now they have one, but we haven't finished it. You know, this is a long-term plan. But even, you know, as we have experience from the past cyclones, you know, we can build structures to withstand category 5, but then that's the first one to be taken out. Even we have some measures, you know, reserve, because it said it's assisting our people. But that's a part of our plan, to build more evacuation centers in these villages, particularly in the villages.
Now that we are just weeks away before the 30th of April, the end of the current cyclone season, with 6 months before November, and I understand during that period, your office and related stakeholders will review the operation and work done during the cyclone season 2020-2021. And as you mentioned, Tonga has been fortunate enough that no tropical cyclone made landfall, but just tropical depressions with minor impacts. CEO, what is a message that you would like to emphasize to the public now?
Preparedness. They have to prepare. Even though we will be running off the cyclone season over the next few weeks, but that's only for the natural disasters like cyclones. We also have other natural disasters like tsunami, earthquake, even eruptions and those things. So it's better to get prepared all the time. That's my message for people. You've got to prepare. And We ourselves at the Ministry of NEMO prepared also to assist our people. But preparedness, once you feel confident when you prepare all the time, because once it hits, we know what to do. Even before it hits, we know what to do. To us, it's building resilience to the people. So preparedness to us is key to resilience.
That was the CEO of the Ministry of Meteorology, Energy, Information, Disaster Management, Environment, Climate Change and Communications, Paula Ma'a, with the latest update on Tonga's preparedness. And as he emphasized, preparedness is key. Mala opito.
Anasiu Falakano from the Tonga Broadcasting Commission reporting.
Helping you stay safe.
Pacific Prepared. When disaster strikes, you may have to evacuate quickly and be away from your home for some time. So, disaster authorities recommend making a kit with some essential items you will need if you have to flee your home. These are commonly known as go bags. Your go bag should be brightly colored and easy to carry, something like a large sports bag or backpack. Some go bags have a lot of items and can be quite expensive. Some cost almost nothing. Each episode, we will bring another item for your go bag, and you can decide if it is right for you and how you can make it work. Duct tape is an inexpensive, strongly adhesive silver gray or black cloth tape. It can solve many problems in an emergency. It can repair holes, seal pipes, and even be used in first aid. It can fix broken eyeglasses, clothing, or be used to hold important items at a safe height. Consider adding duct tape to your go bag. Listen in next time for another item that will help make you ready to go. This information has been drawn from various sources, including the Red Cross, the United Nations, and government agencies. Be informed, be prepared, Pacific prepared.
Kevin Marai from NBC Papua New Guinea helping you to create your go bag. Duct tape might not be readily available in rural and remote areas, so maybe it's an item to add to the list the next time somebody is heading into town. Start your go bag now.
10 minutes after the earthquake, we had a loud bang and then just saw the sea rising up.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do. Pacific Prepared.
When a disaster is set to strike where you live, where do you get your information from? The radio? A text message? Someone else in the village? Early warnings can save lives, but only if they're accurate, they reach people at risk, and they are clearly understood. So how can that be done? Practical Action is an international development organization that has looked at research from around the world and come up with a checklist for the ideal flood early warning system. And it might just help you make better decisions the next time danger threatens. FBC Fiji reporter Josiah Manuka and I spoke with Senior Disaster Risk Reduction Advisor Dr. Mirjana Budimir, and started by asking her to explain what her organisation, Practical Action, does.
It's an international non-profit development organisation. We work across areas such as Latin America, Africa and South Asia. We work across various kind of components and themes such as agriculture and energy, but I work within the disaster risk reduction team, and one of our special specialty focus areas is early warning systems. And really, it's about making sure that the early warning systems that you set up are getting to the right people, get the right information to the right people in the right way, really giving them the right information to be able to take early action. And a lot of the principles, no matter where you try and do early warning systems, are the same. So it's really about kind of extracting that knowledge and applying it in any new context to really try and help people.
Now, what are some of the strategies that the relevant authorities have put together to ensure the effective and efficient dissemination or the warnings are taken across to people in the remote areas?
There's real benefits now in the advancements of technologies to circumvent some of those barriers and getting to those remote areas. Some general principles about making sure people can access it. So thinking about how you send out that warning information, does everyone receive it directly? And that's really maybe not just one method. So for example, in some of the contexts that we work in, warning information is sent out via SMS, via apps. It's sent directly to local responders who disseminate the warning locally. Also sirens and other alerting systems. The internet is becoming much more popular. Facebook, Twitter, national Met services tend to have bulletins or reports that are sent out regularly. The news, the media, radio, TV. And it's really thinking about multiple ways of sending out that information so that there's a greater chance of more people receiving that information, and making sure that when you send that information out that it's tailored. So people require different types of information, and making sure that when you're sending out that you've thought about who's receiving it. Is it appropriate to those people who are receiving it? Is it in the local language? Have you thought about sending out verbally or written? Definitely avoiding technical jargon, and then going back and checking that people are actually understanding it and that that information is useful and that they can do something about it.
Did anything surprise you in your research?
There's a lack of practical guidance around certain aspects of an early warning system. There's a lot of information around monitoring and warning around the kind of more technology aspects of an early warning system. But in terms of how do you work across organizations, that's a lot harder to try and explain and put your finger on exactly what that means. And another area that was definitely missing was whilst we're doing early warning systems, we really got to make sure that everyone is receiving the information and able to act on it. And marginalised people, particularly, for example, based on sex, disability, race, ethnicity, religion, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation and gender identity. These were kind of groups that were the most overlooked, yet they're the most vulnerable to disasters. And that prompted us to do several studies that were digging into primarily gender, and then later further down into kind of other social inequalities that might affect people's experience and access and ability to respond related to early warning systems specifically.
Doctor, did you find that there is a tension as well between traditional knowledge and official warning systems?
Yeah, there's definitely a gap between traditional knowledge and local information and local expertise, and integrating that effectively into essentially kind of top-down national systems. The level of detail that they're kind of operating at is one of the barriers. So if you have a national system, trying to integrate local knowledge into a national system is quite difficult. But there are ways that you can do that. And there's a lot of knowledge in local communities who are experiencing these disasters on a regular basis and have historical knowledge within their family in terms of, you know, what the hazard has or the flood has done before, where is safe, where is not safe, ways of communicating. The informal communication networks we really saw coming out in a lot of our research as it was complementary rather than having one or the other. It's about trying to integrate those two different types of knowledge and two types of resources, both the kind of the more formal scientific technology based systems and knowledge, and the local kind of more informal communication, experiential, maybe not documented or published, but it's still experience and knowledge that exists. And trying to bring those two together is difficult and a gap in early warning systems, definitely.
Doctor, let's take a holistic people-centered approach. What does this mean?
So this is really about getting back to the origin of the purpose of an early warning system. This is about, you know, right information, getting to the right people with enough time to act. And it's going beyond the more technology-based, just monitoring environmental conditions such as rainfall and river levels and just sending out warnings. And it's thinking about the big picture and what's needed to be effective to get that information to the right people to act. And it's thinking about, you know, who is at risk? Do we know that? What are their needs and their capabilities? What information do they need? When do they need it? Do they know what to do when they receive that information? And can they take action? And it's really kind of looking at the whole system, making sure there's no gaps or bottlenecks in communication transfers, etc., and that everyone really knows what they need to do well in advance. And that's everyone from national services to local municipal government responders and local communities, people on the ground.
So we need to listen to officials and apply traditional and local knowledge. A challenge and a balancing act for sure. FBC Fiji reporter Josiah Nanuka speaking with Senior Disaster Risk Reduction Advisor Dr. Miriana Budimir from Practical Action on how to make the perfect flood warning system. There's much more to consider, so we'll have more from that chat in coming episodes. Pacific Prepared is supported by the Pacific Media Assistance Scheme with funding from the Australian Government's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Any views expressed do not necessarily represent those of PACMAS or the Australian government. It is produced and distributed in partnership with Radio Australia and networks across the Pacific, including Radio New Zealand Pacific, NBC Papua New Guinea, Palau Wave Radio, PWFM, Wanomo Capital FM 107 Vanuatu, FBC Fiji, Samoa National Radio 2AP, and TBC Tonga. You can stream all our episodes on the internet. Head to abc.net.au/radio-australia or simply type Pacific Prepared into any search engine and you'll find us. Consider starting a conversation with your family, your community, your co-workers, and think seriously about creating a go bag. We want to help you make the next disaster less disastrous. Thank you to our guests, correspondents and contributors, government and non-government agencies who have provided emergency and disaster information and support for this episode. And thank you for listening. My name is Aaron Carney. We'll be back soon with another episode. In the meantime, please stay safe, share what you have learned here, and together we will get the Pacific prepared.